this is the last this is the last of this four lectures, and I'm really very grateful to Collège de France for giving me this opportunity, because what I said also during the first lecture, what I'm lecturing now is a kind of a book in progress. This is, I have much more questions than answers to some of these topics. And while we didn't have a kind of a discussions, even just articulating certain things in front of people, you start basically to hear them differently. So what I'll do is basically go with this kind of final episode of this saga, and this time I'll try to repeat less, because otherwise half of the lecture is going to be what I said before. But there is a lot of studies and research and discussion in the last several years about the illiberal turn in Central and Eastern Europe. And I like the word illiberal because, unlike populist or right-wing, this is not a term that was basically labeled on the political actors like Mr. Orban, but this is the term that they use themselves. The idea of the illiberal democracy does not come from the critics of these regimes. Basically, this comes from a series of speeches that Prime Minister Orban did. Every summer he's doing a kind of a historical speech. He's always giving it in Transylvania, talking in front of the Hungarian minority in Romania. And for several of these speeches, it was almost like a Collège de France, but with more disciplined public. There was the story that he was explaining what he meant. But while people were discussing what happened, and of course the surprise was very big, there was always three elements. The first is, it was seen much more as the crisis of democratization than the crisis of democracy. The idea was what went wrong with the transitions in Eastern Europe. Secondly, there was a tendency to see this very much as an East European problem, not basically the European problem. And this was quite strong, and there was two kind of a dominant discourses trying to explain what happened. One, of course, was the economic discourse. And when people have been asked why basically governments like the peace government in Poland or Mr. Orban have been elected, one of the popular explanations was that you have the economic losers of the reforms that have been mobilized by these governments, and this is why they came to power. In the beginning, some of these arguments were much more convincing than they are now. And to be honest, it was quite convincing in the case of Hungary when in 2000 Mr. Orban was first elected, but it was not particularly convincing in the case of Poland, because when peace came to power in 2015, and for sure there was losers of the reforms, and there was people who basically have been very much hurt by certain economic policies. But keep in mind that Poland was the fastest growing economy in Europe in the last 20 years. Secondly, contrary to some other countries, the social inequality in Poland has been declining, not increasing. So this was not the classical explanation. And thirdly, if you go at the voters' base, at peace, of course, you're going to see some of the losers of the reforms, but you're much more going to see how important was the territorial distinction, the urban-rural divide, what we have been talking about. It was not so much about incomes. It was much more where do people live. It was very much what in French discourse is going to be the periphery and how they have been seeing what was going on. So when in 2015, after basically peace was elected, there was an interview with Adam Przeworski, one of the classics in democratic theory, and they asked him how he's going to explain the peace victory in terms of democratic theory. He responded in a very kind of a nice way. He said, if we're going to trust the democratic theory, this should not have happened. And this is an important story, because since then, one important thing happened. These governments have been re-elected. So the explanation for the success of populists, if you're going to reduce them to a protest vote, can easily explain why they have been elected once And by the way, Adam Michnik, one of the key figures in the Polish liberal community, after the peace was elected, made this final very kind of a quoted statement, which is not going to be praised for its political correctness, but he said, "It happened to a beautiful woman. To go is a bastard." The problem is that probably this beautiful woman decided to marry the bastard. And this is a different story. And this is why the economic explanation, while valid on certain terms and explaining support for certain groups, by the way, there was also some, in my view, very reasonable economic policies coming from the peace government after it was elected, particularly with respect to certain very low-income groups. This cannot be the explanation only. The second explanation, which was very much popular, was the idea of the backsliding. And I should confess to you that I very much hate the term, which is very popular in the political science when they said Central and East Europeans backslided on democracy. Backsliding is a term that comes from religious discourse and normally was referring to the converted Jews that went back to their bad habits from before. And I'm saying this because the term of the backsliding captured something very important about kind of Western Europeans and also Americans' puzzlement when it talks to explain what is happening in the East of European Union. And the story was, if you basically read the commands, but also political theories that have coming after the end of the Cold War, and you're reading all this thousands of articles and books on the democratic transition, you're going to see the transformation of Eastern Europe, democratization, European integration. The way it was told, the way it was analyzed, very much fits a famous play by Bernard Shaw from the beginning of the 20th century, which probably some of you know. It's called Pygmalion. Pygmalion was a big hit both in Europe and in London in the eve of the World War I. And this is the story of a low-class flower girl and the professor in phonetics. And the professor betted that he can basically teach her to speak and behave like a lady, society lady, in a very short period of time. And he won the bet. He learned her to speak like a lady, to behave like a lady. It was such a popular play that some of the theater directors that have been staging it insisted that the flower girl should marry the professor. And then Bernard Shaw went kind of mad and he said, "You don't understand. They can never marry because he is going to treat her like a student while she wanted to be treated like a lady, because she learned to be a lady." So they didn't marry. So of course you can expect certain level of disappointment and this kind of a row between the model of the West and the imitators from the East. But with the emergence of illiberal regimes in Central and Eastern Europe, something different was happening. And from this point of view, of course, Hungary was much more important than Poland. Because it was not anymore in the beginning, you have the feeling that you're just watching Pygmalion and the problem is the professor going to marry the girl? But then you understand that it's not about Pygmalion, it's about Frankenstein. In a certain way, you have the creator who basically created a monster that tries to destroy him. One of the geniuses of some of the constitutional engineering that came after the electoral victory of the Fidesz in Hungary was that, for example, they voted in the parliament a media law that scandalized almost all European member states. But do you know what was the most interesting about the media law? It was borrowing articles that each of them exist in some of the other EU member states. It was obviously an illiberal legislation, but all of it was assembled by a parts that have been part of a liberal constitutions in other places. And the story, can you have illiberal regime under the cover of a liberal constitution, was the biggest issue. And this type of discussions and this type of analysis of what was happening in Central and Eastern Europe, and of course, Hungary and Poland have been the most visible countries, but there was discussions of many others, have been at the center. And most of the analysis was based on try to analyze in normative terms what they're doing wrong. For example, independence of the media. Obviously, there is a huge problem with the try to dominate the media. And in the case of Hungary, you have a concentration of media power that you're not going to see even in some of non-democratic countries, honestly speaking. In the others, you're going to talk about political polarization. From this point of view, Poland very much resembles the United States. You have two Polands which are have difficulty talking to each other. But when I was reading all this analysis and also being partially part of them, I had the feeling that we're missing three things, and this is where this basically lecture series comes from. First, we can explain what the governments are doing, but in order to do it, we're trying basically to reduce them simply as norms violators. They're doing something different than we expected them to do, but we're not very good at explaining why they're doing this. Is there a project? Or it is simply about preserving power? And secondly, if they understand why they're doing it, why they're concentrating power, why a sizable part of the population supports them? And this is a reality. And this is, you cannot explain everything by media control. So how it happened, what is behind it, what kind of anxieties they have been captured in order to get this support, and certainly to what extent the emergence of these regimes are telling us something about the future of democracy, but also the future of the European Union. So then is when very much I tried to look around and the problem of demography came up. And for those of you that have been on more than one lecture, you know that one of the things that really interests me is the demographic anxiety that comes in Eastern Europe. It's all over Europe, but in Eastern Europe for very specific reasons by three factors. One is major loss of population for the last 30 years. Demographically, and I'm repeating it because it's important to see the scale, many of Central and East European countries lost up to 10 or 15% of their population. And the result was low fertility rates, but honestly speaking, fertility rates on the European average level, but also because of out-migration. A lot of young people have left the countries, and not only young people. They're here, they're studying, and so on. And this created a particular kind of attention because these regimes became very visible from outside during the refugee crisis of 2015, being very much hostile to the migrants in the absence of migration, because none of our countries has a big refugee population as a result of this crisis. But people didn't understand that one of the drama of East Europeans in this moment was that the best thing and the worst thing that has happened to us is the same thing, opening of the borders. The best because all of us are totally benefiting out of it and being here. I'm a classical example of this. You come, you have the possibility to study, to work, to move. So in individual and personal terms, you're benefiting incredibly from the opening of the borders within the European Union. From the point of view of the nation state, this huge outflow of population was perceived as a problem on several levels. First, on economic level, which now more and more you're seeing in Central and Eastern Europe, is that we start to have labor shortages. So nevertheless of what you're basically going to hear about migration in Central and Eastern Europe, keep in mind that the EU member states that receive the highest number as a percent of economic migrants for the last 4 years is no France and it is no Germany, but it is Poland. 2 million Ukrainians now work in Poland, including, by the way, 20,000 Pakistanis. So because of this kind of out-migration, basically in order to sustain their economies and to sustain their labor markets, all of these countries open themselves while not talking much about it. By the way, one of the most liberal labor migration regimes in the European Union is the one in Hungary. The only problem is that, of course, they prefer to get so-called golden visas, rich Chinese and others coming and basically investing in the country, but very basically, very easily giving them the residence and possibility to live there. The second thing that comes as a result of the out-migration is, and which is going to be important for the further argument that I want to do, is you had a major change in the electoral mixture of society. Because mostly younger people are living, and people who are much more mobile, people like to talk about brain drain. It's not only brain, everything was draining. Different type of people were living there. It's not only the best educated. But one of the things is that you start to have even more generational asymmetry than you have in the Western societies. In a certain way, Central and East European society starts to misuse. If you see at the electoral body, you're going to see that the number of people under 30 voting is around 15%. This is kind of a disbalance that is critically important for any democracy because it changes the time perspective. How far you're ready to plan, how much you're basically trying to do it. And certainly, what Central and East Europeans discovered was that it's not simply that people are living, but out-migration is also transfer of money from the East to the West. Because all money invested in the education of these people who left, in a certain way, live with them. And while there was a lot of talks and studies about, and there was a huge amount of money that had been transferred from the West to the East, this transfer from the East to the West became visible very much around this type of a migration-emigration debates, but also it became very visible around COVID, because one of the areas in which this is very visible is in the public health. As you know, I don't know how is France, but Germany is lacking 100,000 medical professionals in order basically to fit the system. So if you are East European and does not need to be even the member of the EU, if you are Serb or Albanian or Kosovars, and if you have a medical education, be a nurse or a doctor, you're immediately going to get a job and residence in Germany, immediately. As a result of it, what we discovered, for example, in Bulgaria during the COVID crisis is that the average age of the Bulgarian medical personnel is above 50. So in some of the provincial hospitals, there was 70 plus retired doctors have been mobilized to take care of the people. By the way, the risk that they took in the first 2 months when there was no protection, nothing there. So this creates this very strange feeling that demographically we're declining. And I was always giving Bulgarian data because this is the most impressive one. But in the year 1989, the Bulgarian population was around 9 million. Now it is around 7 million. And 2040, the projections of the demographers is going to be 5.5 million. So the idea of the demographic decline, which is also perceived as a decadence, as kind of a major loss, created this sentiment in which you have a society which otherwise extremely pro-European. From this point of view, you don't have the idea of exiting the European Union. From this point of view, what you have even on East European far right is very different than what you have in Western Europe. This is not Brexit type of a mood, but the mood is what it means for us. And this is why demographic imagination, which is based on three realities and one kind of imagination issue. First, you have a shrinking population. Secondly, you have an aging population. And thirdly, you have a much more movement of people. And this is quite clear because people are moving much more in the world these days, much easier. And also because the difference between different places in the world and the way people live are also very different. This created a very specific demographic anxiety, and because this demographic projection started to be taken by people as if something that has already happened, that became the major discourse of these governments. This is not the nationalism of the 19th century, which is about expanding territories. And this is even not basically the classical ethnic homogeneity argument, which was typical for the 20th century, and I have been giving this argument in the previous three lectures, that one of the important things that happened in 20th century in Central and Eastern Europe is that this region of Europe, which was ethnically and culturally most diverse in the beginning of 20th century, ended up as ethnically most homogeneous because of the policy transfers, the destruction of the Jews, basically the expulsion of the Germans, and as a result of it, most of our countries has a population which is 90-95% ethnically homogeneous, and this ethnic homogeneity was perceived as the preconditions for the existence of the state. So when all these things went together, you have the possibility for the illiberal project, which is based on the fact that all these ethnic communities are very much in threat of simply vanishing and disappearing. And the only way to be preserved is by coming from a special type of an ethnic state, which should also remain democratic, that can protect them from the pressure of globalization. And here is what is, from this point of view, interesting for political scientists in these liberal-illiberal debates. While most of the people try to describe populism or illiberalism in Central and Eastern Europe, as I told you, and try to see how they're violating liberal norms, my idea was to say, listen, what this demographic anxiety is doing is creating a major tension between two different majorities which exist in our political space. One is the majority that is created by the nation states, because Central and East European states, unlike West European states, they have never been an empires. They came as a result of the disintegration of the empires. And these states were based on the idea that there is a majority which is culturally national in its nature, and it is a permanent majority. Bulgarians are a permanent majority in Bulgaria. Poles are a permanent majority in Poland. Hungarians are a permanent majority in Hungary. And then comes the moment in which, with the democratization, democracy is not about permanent majority. Democracy is about all the time changing majorities. Because in a democracy, majority is produced in every elections, and this basically majority can have a very different composition. You can have minority parties being part of it. It can be defined differently. But there is a tacit agreement that the democratic majority produced on the elections cannot challenge the cultural nature of the state. And then you have a democracy in the ethnic states, which was not problematic to the extent that the states have been very homogeneous. But suddenly, because of all these demographic anxieties I was talking about, you have a very important phenomenon which you can see in the West, but a much more visible in the West. This is the phenomenon of the threatened majority. This is a big majority groups that starts to have all the fears of a minority groups. You have the fear that you're losing power, basically that. And here is a very important also ethical issue. Should you feel sorry for them? Is this basically defense of identity, or is this defense of power? And if different groups are going basically to frame it very differently. What exactly basically you're trying to preserve? Your power or your identity? But keeping in mind that you're talking also about very small ethnic group and nations, the fear that you're going to lose your language. And by the way, it's not for the first time. You go back to the 19th century and you're going to see the fear of all these ethnic communities that they're going to lose their cultural identity. For example, in 19th century, Isaiah Berlin is quoting two teachers in Czech language talking to each other, and one said, "We're probably the last generation that speaks Czech, because now everybody is going to speak German, because the German was the language of the educated classes." In Bulgaria, it was very much with the problem of the Greek language at the end of the Ottoman Empire. This was the language of the educated classes, the people who basically wanted to get status. So this is why this story of the rights of majorities and what it means to defend majorities in a political system in which they have the numbers and basically democracy is defending them is the biggest issue. And here what I'm claiming is that if we're going to see liberalism and illiberalism not simply as the violation of liberal rights, not simply as the corrupt nature of certain political regimes, not just the historical legacy of certain societies, but as a two political projects, then, and you're going to hear this for the fourth time, but for me this is so important, my methodological starting point is a poem by Brecht in 1953 in a totally different context, when he said, if the government does not like the people, why the government decided not to dissolve the people and to elect a new one? the fear that the government can come and they can elect the people different than the people that exist became the major preoccupation, and these parties are saying, we are here not to allow this to happen. So as a result of it, suddenly the right to vote, the right to be part of political community became an ethnic privilege. The difference between East and West is exactly what kind of people you want to elect. How are you imagining that in a period in which you're going to have these demographic changes going for a longer time, how are you going to deal with the new diversity? Because normally people said, but people have been always moving. Here's the difference. In 20th century, people have been moving, and as a result of it, states were becoming more and more homogeneous. Now people are moving and states are becoming much more and more diverse. The movement probably can be the same. You can imagine how actively people have been moving during the wars. From the point of view of the political democracy, this is critically important because democracy is also a numbers game. In a democratic narrative, power changes when people change their mind, but power changes also when population changes. And this is why, on one side, you have the liberal response to this new diversity, in which is, we'll try to come with a type of a political identity which is reduced in its kind of a cultural intensity, so it makes it easier for others to become part of it. And this is why you're trying to constitutionalize certain type of things. For example, it could be French language, or it could be... France is a great example of this kind of, because of the Republican tradition, in which the most important of my project is to make it easy for others to become French. By the way, this is not... we're saying this as if this is a kind of a nature of things, but it was not like this. The problem with integration and even assimilation historically was always much more complex than this. People have now normally believes that we are worried because others do not assimilate well. But don't forget, the biggest problem with the German Jews in the eyes of the Nazis was that they assimilated too well. That you cannot distinguish between German and Jew, because the Jews knew Goethe better than the Germans. So from this point of view, there is this problem. If others can easily become like me, who am I? I'm saying this because, of course, this when you have this liberal project, it also is going to have its difficult moments. And the difficult moments are coming answering the biggest question. What is a state if it is not a nation? And if this is the case, first, how easy, when you said, let's make people French, it's more difficult than ever before to know exactly what it means to be French or to be Swiss or to be German. And secondly, do you have a moral right and how far you can push others to do it, particularly when you have a flourishing type of identities everywhere and for people very much important to express their uniqueness, their differences. We're living in a society in which everybody wants to be unique. And this kind of a cultural trend to be different is very different than the type of cultural context which existed in the time of a kind of a classical civic nation, went through armies, through industrialization, through a totally different way of life. It was much more easy to make out of peasants French. And on the other side, and this is going to be an issue, it's going to be defined in all different countries, but this is the liberal project, make it easier. Try to diminish the ethnic nature of the state in order to make it easier for the others. And then you have the illiberal project. And the illiberal project is not about closing the borders. And for me, this is very important because then people are going to be surprised to see how many foreigners you're going to see in these countries. This is closing the body politic. Strangely enough, and this probably psychologically is not difficult to explain, but people have most difficulty to understand when somebody is adopting things that they have been just rejected yesterday. What you see, what is the logic of East European illiberal governments towards foreigners, this is the classical German, but also French from this period, politics of guest workers. You can come, you can work, but I don't have an interest and incentives basically to make you German. You're here, move. You can go back if you want, or you can go somewhere else. For me, integrating you is not perceived as a political incentive. I need you for special labor. I'm very much doing this. And this is interesting because in a classical history of the development of rights, and this is famous Marshall's three-stage development, basically he said it was 18th century when basically Europe discovered the right of religion, the right of expression, and then it came 19th century with the political rights, which was basically the right to be part of a political party, to association, and of course the right to vote. And the right to vote had been expanded, and from the political privilege, it became kind of a right for the citizens. And certainly, and he said, the most contested rights is the rights in the 20th century about social rights. What is happening in the illiberal response to this globalized world is that it is not the social rights that are most contested, paradoxically, but the political rights. Most of the people who are going to come and work in Bulgaria or Hungary or Poland, they're going to have some of the social rights. What they're not going to have is going to be the right to vote. And from this point of view, you're going to have the interesting composition of the body politics. And this is something that I very much interested to continue to work on, because my question is, what kind of a democracy you're going to have, and what kind of a problems you can solve in the electoral politics if 20-25% of the people who are on the labor market do not have the right to vote. 40-50% of the voters are on a retirement age. And 10-15% of those who are voting are living outside of the country, so they do not pay taxes in the country. This kind of connection between taxation and participation, between economic activity and political activity, has been very much divorced. And this is quite important, because if this is the case, it's very difficult, many of the economic issues, to be solved on this level. Because the stakeholders have a very diverse interest on this. Then, day by day, democratic politics is becoming about identity, about symbolic politics. And I'm saying this, and of course, this kind of understanding of politics is also very well seen if you see how the certain governments are trying to change the electoral laws and to try to make it clear that for them this symbolic politics is critically important. In the Hungarian electoral law, Hungarians living outside of Hungary have the right to vote. And there, as you know, big Hungarian minorities in Serbia, in Romania. Hungary was a country which, after the World War I, lost almost two-thirds of its population as a result of the treaties. But here's an interesting difference. If you're Hungarian who is living in Romania, in Transylvania, you can vote by post. But if you're a Hungarian professor in the Collège de France, you still can vote, but you should go to vote in the embassy. Paradoxically, the most true Hungarians are not those in Hungary. And this story of creating a political community which is very much defined by origin and not by participation in economic, social, and political life creates this logic of this type of regimes. And this is why when they talk to their political opponents within the political space, for them they are traitors, but they are traitors particularly in the fact that they do not stand for basically the national majority to be the one guaranteed in the elections. So from this point of view, in order to show how much it is contested on a day-to-day basis, let's give you two examples. And on the last, in the last lecture, I shared with you that many of the problems that Central and East European countries face are not very different than the problems that Israel faces, being a democracy in the ethnic state. The two facts are the following. Avrom Burg was one of the very important figures on the Zionist left in Israel. He was a speaker of the Israeli parliament till 2003. Before it, he was the head of the Jewish agency that was very much basically in charge of integrating the Jews who came to Israel. But in December last year, he publicly asked to be taken out of the registry as a Jew. Of course, this was a major shock for the country. And the story was why. And he said, because as a result of the ethnic nature of the state, I don't want to be part of a master race. I don't want to be part of it. I want to believe that I can defend my Jewish culture. And he's very Zionist. He's very Jewish. He's, by the way, a very famous philosopher working a lot on classical Jewish texts. So this is not a cosmopolitan type of a story of somebody who is not interested in his Jewishness. But he said, I had the fear that my identity is threatened as a Jew because we made the problem of the Jewishness so much of power relations, not identity relations, that in the long term, we can pay for this. This is not the popular move for many people, and people basically said that he went crazy. But this type of tensions between the two majorities that I was telling you yesterday is very clear there. And on the other side, just several days ago, after the Polish Constitutional Court, which is very much, and this is not a secret to anybody, under the influence of the government, decided to declare that basically Polish Constitution has a priority over the European legal order, there was a major demonstrations in several cities, including Warsaw, in which we have around 100,000 people, but it was not the interesting one. It was the interest, the language, that the leader of the opposition and the former president of the European Union, of the European Council, Donald Tusk, used. He accused the government of being traitors. He said, you're traitors because with this move, you're pushing the country outside of the European Union, you go against the majority of the wish of the Poles. And this is true that more than 70% of the Poles insist that the country should stay. Why this is interesting? Because the language of traitors was always used till this moment by the peace government against the opposition. They were traitors of the nation. They basically love Brussels more than they love Poland. They're ready to betray Polish national interest because of their loyalty. Why I'm saying this? Because using the word traitor, Tusk, who, by the way, is a very gifted politician. He's a typical East European politician, so this is not a kind of a simply an intellectual game. He knows what he speaks. Was an attempt to redefine what is a nation, because when you define what is a nation, you know what it means to betray it. And this type of tensions you're going to see everywhere. And here the story is, to what extent the existence of the European Union makes it easier or more difficult for these illiberal regimes to establish themselves. And I'm not speaking in financial terms, things that people are discussing a lot about money, but about basically cultural room for maneuvering and to what extent basically this makes it more difficult and how the relations between these two different choices that you have at this moment are going to develop. I'm saying this because paradoxically, the fact that you're going to have a lot of people working in your country and not voting in it is not something that is unknown in Europe. I'm living in Vienna. 40% of the population of Vienna do not vote because we are coming from other places. We are voting in our own countries. But we are not voting in Vienna. For the mayor of Vienna, we cannot vote. We can only on the very kind of a district level. We, of course, cannot vote on the Austrian elections, but of course, we can vote on European elections. So suddenly, you have a political bodies that have been very much deteriorated. Political community became much more abstract. They are not so much meeting each other. They are basically connected to things which are not always related to how you're governing specific territory. And if you decide to change this, this is not going to be easy, because then comes a very simple questions: for whom these people will vote? And then the decision of how to open the body politics is going to be very much with the suspicion that I'm opening to certain type of groups and voters because I do believe this is going to benefit me. This is the classical fear of the Republican Party that basically the Democrats are going to open and give political rights to migrants because they believe that the minorities are voting for them. And by the way, this is interesting story and we talked about this. Funnily enough, this fixation on the ethnic identities, particularly in the American politics, covers the fact that political reality shows totally different things. By the way, President Trump, as probably many of you know, increased his share of the vote of the minorities on the last elections. What is even more, in year 2000, when George W. Bush was elected for the President of the United States, the Republican Party strategists were sure that opening of the borders to migration from Central and Latin America is the way to create a permanent Republican majority, because many of these people are Catholic believers, much more conservative on social issues, be it abortion, being also some other issues. And thirdly, most of them start their life in the United States in the states that are governed by the Republicans, so their socialization go this way, and George W. Bush got around 40% of the vote of the Latino voters. So I'm saying all this because one of the problems with the demographic obsession is that it starts to create demographic determinism. And it is very much what Europeans see coming from the United States. And this is also part of the American influence on the European politics. Because with the exception of the black community, which for very important historical reasons is really very much voting in a big majority for one of the political parties, the vote of many other groups is changing a lot. And if you see the voting behavior, for example, of the Germans from the Turkish origin that have been basically getting citizenship, you're going to see first that they're voting for different political parties. Many other things have been more important than their ethnic background. For example, membership in the trade unions was critically important back then. But also that they're changing their vote. But if you go to think in demographic terms about politics, then you're always going to fear that population change is going to meet a power change. And then you're going to act like this. And as a result of it, and here basically I want to make the last point, is that this explains something that I'm afraid that we're going to see in the coming years, and not only in Eastern Europe, in Western Europe, it's everywhere. The result of political polarization and the democratic fears is that it is going to be more and more difficult for the party that loses the elections to accept the election results. Because they always are going to believe that the moment they lose, a different population kind of a decision can be taken, which is going basically to hurt them. And you're going to have more and more contested elections, because the democratic politics in the way we know it is very much based on the idea of the settled and stabilized population levels. And this is changing. And there is a lot of talks about how social media technologies are going to change the democratic politics. There is a lot of talk how basically they're going to change European Union. But one of the weaknesses in our analysis is that we don't know how to talk about the demographic change. And the reason is that the discourse on democracy is almost totally monopolized by the far right everywhere. And as a result of it, out of the fear to justify this discourse, people try not to understand that for a big number of people, these are real issues. And I'm going to enter something which is going to basically give a prospect why I do believe this is important for understanding both the nature of the liberal regimes, but also their own evolutions. Listen, some of these governments are going to lose power. Out of them losing power does not mean that all of these anxieties are going to disappear. And this is the major issue that I do believe we should try to talk. Obviously, our societies are going to end up in a period in which we're really going to renegotiate some of the basic idea of what it belongs to a state, what it belongs to a political community. And also, every political community is defined not by how it includes, but how it excludes. Because political community is exclusive in its nature. Because what keeps people together in a political community is the fact that we have decided together to decide on how to govern ourselves. And the exclusion can have it very different forms. I remember a beautiful slogan, poster from years ago, which I saw in Netherlands. And this was the poster with Gullit, the famous football players, which probably somebody who is older remember. He was a very famous Dutch football player. And the text was, Netherlands is full, racists out. So in a certain way, the problem of everybody tries to exclude because this is how you define what is a political community. Democracy always excludes. People decide who to decide to be part or not, being ideas, being discourses. And as a result of it, to try to minimize the importance of some of this demographic anxiety of the people, the fact that they are going to age and they don't know exactly how it's going to be, the fact that many of them basically have the feeling that they cannot imagine their societies in 20, 30 years, is going to be at the cost of making basically our democracy legitimate in the eyes of our own citizens. So as I was trying to say when I started this series of lectures, what I like about Collège de France, of what I have read about it, is that this is a place where people are tolerated even when they just come with questions than when they come with answers. But I have the feeling that we reach the moment in which asking the right questions is becoming even much more difficult to come with any type of an answers. So I want really to thank you very much for wasting your time listening to my questions. I'll be very happy if somebody has any questions to try to answer them.